This episode is brought to you by the Arvada Center, because they're kicking off their summer concert series in June. Relax under the stars at the Arvada Center's outdoor amphitheater and take in acts like Melissa Etheridge, Big Richard, Tower of Power, Preservation Hall Jazz Band, The Spin Doctors, and so much more. Concerts are scheduled for June through September. You can find a whole schedule of events and get your tickets today at arvadacenter.org. That's arvadacenter.org. Today on CityCast Denver, Mayor Mike Johnston is back to answer our questions and yours about the ongoing Gaza protests at Auraria campus, the latest on his effort to end homelessness in Denver, city employees' right to collective bargaining, and of course, his review of the new Taylor Swift album. And just because the situation at Auraria is changing so fast, you should know we taped this conversation on Tuesday in the late afternoon. Today is Thursday, May 2nd. I'm Bree Davies, and here's what Denver's talking about. Mayor Mike Johnston, welcome back to CityCast Denver.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
And producer Paul Caroli is here.
Hey, Bree.
Hey. So, Mayor, we saw you at the NFL draft, but the Avs and the Nugs are killing it in the playoffs.
My gosh.
The Rockies are certainly a team that exists. Who are you watching right now?
I'm watching the Avs and the Nuggets obsessively right now. And so, and it's just an incredibly exciting time. I don't know if folks know this, but there are three potential firsts. You know, Denver was the first city in America ever to win a Stanley Cup and an NBA championship within the same 12 months because we won back-to-back.
Oh.
We would be the first city ever if we won them in the same year.
We did it again.
And also, no city ever has had an NHL MVP or a Hart Trophy winner and an NBA MVP in the same year. So if Jokic and McKinnon both win, that also would be a first. So these are like the halcyon days of maybe the greatest sports moment
Seriously.
In Denver history. And so I'm excited for people to soak it up, because you don't get the chance to watch like Nathan McKinnon play on one night and Jokic and Murray play on the next, and that's just your normal hometown. So it is an amazing time. And you may have seen we've started these super fun marches we do from downtown to Ball Arena. So on Avs nights, we start at Larimer Square. On Nuggets night, we start at Union Station. People come, have a drink, hang out, eat dinner, and then we go with the mascots and the bands and march through town over to the stadium.
Oh my gosh. This
great snowball feeling. You just pick people up at all the bars and the restaurants along the
yes.
way, and you jump in and dance your way over to Ball Arena.
I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah, it
sounds
either.
So fun.
It's really fun. So come to, and now the idea is, and we also give away free tickets to the game thanks to the Avs and Nuggets every night. As soon as you want to come on the march and you don't have tickets yet, you may end up inside the game. So we're doing
that. Even playoffs right now?
Even playoffs. We're doing it. It's just a playoff special. We're doing this it's a playoff tradition we want to start for Denver, where every spring when we're in the playoffs, which we will be for a long time, you come
every
downtown,
spring, yeah.
hang out, have a drink, and then march over to the stadium. And then, you know, when we get to hopefully the finals, there'll be outdoor playoff watching parties and stuff too.
Yeah.
But right now it's the march, and it's really fun.
That's awesome.
This reminds me of something our friend Adam Modis from DNVR was talking about when we had him on last year during the
yeah.
Nuggets run. He said that Stan Kroenke, the owner of the team, he's talking about redeveloping the Ball Arena parking lots.
Yes.
He had this idea of calling that street out in front of Union Station, I think the Sports Mile or something. Do you know
it.
About this project?
We do know definitely about the project to redevelop Ball Arena and really
yeah.
to make it more of a residential neighborhood. So the idea is take, you know, those 50 acres of parking lots you have around most stadiums and get rid of those and make them actually residential. You can have concerts there, you can have parks, you can have outdoor venues, you can have art events. So we're really excited about that. There'd be potentially a bridge that would go over Spear that would make it easier to access for pedestrian and bridge.
Great.
Yeah, and then the idea is, yeah, you come hang out in downtown, have some drinks. You could go from Coors Field all the way over to Ball Arena and see, you know, Mammoth also champions in the last couple of years. So if we could get the Rockies, you'd have four world champions all in the same street.
Well, what's the latest on that project that you've heard from the Kroenke organization?
Oh, we've
the redevelopment.
Yeah, we've sat down with them. It's going through council for approval this spring in terms of the approvals for the various permits and projects and zoning for that project. The art of the zoning is mostly already been approved, so we think it's moving forward. And, you know, there's going to be a huge chunk of affordable housing there, which we're really excited about, because the idea is make downtown a neighborhood, but also make it a neighborhood for everybody, so it's not just luxury units. There'll be a senior living facility, so for all of the hip seniors that want to have the coolest place to live in downtown, you got a great spot. So we're really excited about it and think it's going to be a great, you know, our vision really is to use that to link kind of downtown with Ball Arena and also with the Auraria campus. Yeah. So then you have three really activated spaces. There's also a project going on in Auraria, as you may know, to build student and faculty housing on that campus. So there's more housing on site because we want to really activate that. So those three parts we think fit together into a really great new addition to a vibrant downtown.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something we've been watching for the last couple of years, and we'll continue to watch. But you mentioned Auraria campus.
Yes.
That's our first big topic we want to get to, is these ongoing protests we've seen from students. I think they're still occupying space out on the Tivoli Quad, a few dozen students, some community members. They're calling on the colleges, the three colleges, to divest from Israel in a number of different ways. We will not talk about the police presence there Friday yep. night. You were there. There were some arrests. Tell us about the decision to send police to arrest protesters.
Let me just say a couple things in context. Obviously, we're very proud of the fact that we've had, I think, protests in Denver every week since October 7th, really. And we've had them at city council month after month. And we've handled all of those, we think, with allowing people to speak their peace, speak their truth, and be peaceful. We haven't had arrests or incidents, even though we've had to sometimes shut down city council. Work's gotten done. We didn't have incidents. And so we're very proud of that. I think, as you may know, the Auraria campus is a much more complicated animal because it is state land. But on state land, you have three different universities. You have Metro State, you have the Community College of Denver, and the University of Colorado at Denver. And then you have a campus administration called the Auraria Higher Ed Campus, which is sort of the government body that oversees all the public spaces and the police forces there. So they have their own police force called the Auraria Higher Ed Police Force, or the Auraria PD. And they have the capacity to ticket, enforce, et cetera, on that campus. And so they have a campus policy against camping and against sleeping overnight and against demonstrating on that quad without a permit. And so they decided as a campus to enforce that campus policy and remove those tents.
But those were DPD officers.
Yeah, so I'll also get to that. So whenever there is an action that the Auraria campus moves on, they will sometimes ask for backup from police department or others. And so the Auraria team made the decision when they got there to ticket folks for trespass. So there were, I think, 45 tickets that day. 40 of those were all written by the Auraria police. They were not written by ours. The only four tickets that were written by the Denver Police Department were for assault of an officer or for interference of officers that were trying to manage that situation. So because the Auraria police does not have a jail or a site, if they ticket or arrest someone, they have to be transported to the Denver County Jail. So it's a little confusing that Auraria writes a ticket, it ends up in our city attorney's office to prosecute, and you get placed into our jail to be processed. And so I arrived, I was flying back Friday from Detroit when that first happened. I landed, came over to the site, visited with all the university presidents, met with our police department and their team, talked to the protesters, and we've been working with them since then to try to peacefully get a path for both, to make sure the campus can function for everything from graduation to finals to the rest, and to make sure people can protest peacefully. And so our policy and approach has not been to ticket people for trespass or to arrest them for trespass. That's not been our policy or approach, and that's not something that we would propose the DPD does in this context. Obviously, Auraria has their own team, their own police, their own strategy, and so we will collaborate if there is any future action on what roles we would play, but we would not plan to arrest people for trespass.
But you clearly condoned it. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you were there enforcing the policy. You were asking the students to leave.
So
Can
I was
you
there.
Tell us about that decision?
Yeah, yeah. So I was there Friday. I met with the university presidents, asked them about their needs, and their request was, we respect people's right to protest peacefully. We can't have structures and in the middle of the campus quad, which is a violation of our school regulation. And so we need to be able to bring those tents down. So what we'd said to people is, this is the campus policy. They need to enforce it. So we need to bring the tents down so they can enforce that policy. As I said that night, it continues to be our plan. We don't have any intention or desire to make arrests or to make citations. We want to be able to bring those down peacefully. That was why I showed up. But it is a collaboration between, you know, it is their campus. That they're the ones that need to negotiate with their own students on whatever the requests are or suggestions are. We don't have governance authority over that campus. We are in a support role as a supporting law enforcement organization. Their campus policies are their own, and then we try to collaborate in the places that we can help in ways that we think are appropriate.
I mean, so do you empathize with the students? Like, do you support them, their right to do this,
yeah,
their actions? Because I'm worried about the future. Because we've seen these protests get violent on other campuses. You're saying you want to continue working with the campus administrators. Is there a future where you would send DPD officers, or you could see the city having a bigger role to play in these protests?
Yeah. So so obviously we support the right of people to peacefully protest. We know that there are very strongly held feelings about this conflict for very good reasons on both sides, and people should have the ability to share those. And so what we want to do is create the ecosystem where people can do that and people on both sides feel safe for those opinions to be shared. And I think we've done that at city council. We've done that in city protests. And so I think what we have made clear in terms of what we would partner on going forward is that we would not, as DPD, we would not be involved in ticketing people for trespass or ticketing people for peaceful protest. We would not be a part of arresting people for peaceful protest unless people get violent or they're resistant or they interfere with police activity. Those are the stages in which we would pursue arrests. Other than that, we would not want to be a part of having DPD officers issue either arrests or citations for trespass. That's not been our policy. That was not what we did on Friday. That's not what we would do going forward.
Have you talked to city council about it? I'm thinking about this letter that went around that was signed by several city council members as well as state legislators supporting the students and not supporting the arrests or removing the encampments.
I have talked to city council members individually multiple times, and I've talked to them as a group this morning. We had an executive session to discuss this at city council. So I've been in frequent contact with them. I'm aware of their feedback, and this is where, again, that's harder for me because it's not my campus. I don't get to negotiate to say, let's sit down with the when I talk to the students, they have a bunch of requests I obviously can't meet because I'm not the campus administrator. And it's up to them what they do want to do. So we're trying to be mindful of, what policies they choose, what they choose to enforce is a campus decision, the same way if CU Boulder decides to do that. I don't have direct authority, even though it's not in Boulder. I think they're working hard. I know there was some conversations and negotiations going on today where those presidents were sitting down with protesters. We've tried to facilitate that in any way that we can because we are talking to people that we trust and respect on both sides to try to get people to the best possible solution where they can both be heard and also be safe.
This episode is brought to you by Pine Melon, the farmer's market delivered. Pine Melon is a next generation grocery delivery app that partners with over 200 farmers, ranchers, and producers in Colorado to help make fresh, locally sourced foods available to the Denver community at fair prices. Get high quality meats, eggs, and dairy from small local farms, fresh baked breads from local bakeries, and more, as well as all of your favorite pantry staples. Best part is, Pine Melon offers same-day delivery to Denver and soon Boulder within a two-hour window, no subscription necessary. Save time in your busy schedule and get fresh and healthy groceries delivered right to your door. Join the movement and support local today. Use promo code CITYCASTDENVER for $75 off your first delivery at pinemelon.com. That's pinemelon.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. We're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So we want to talk about homelessness, which is something we've been talking with you since the beginning of this, even in your campaign stage. You promised not to sweep any encampments without offering housing to people being swept. But a couple weeks ago, you ordered the camp at 8th and Navajo and La Alma Lincoln Park to be swept, and you didn't offer housing. Why?
Yeah, one key component, which has been true, is we've always said we won't sweep encampments without access to housing unless there is public health or safety risk, there is right-of-way infringement, or there's infringement on private property. So that's always been true. I mean, we were very proud of the fact we hadn't closed an encampment without housing for almost 6 months, but we had done it before. If you remember, there was one downtown where we had a rat infestation that was very serious. We had one that was on private property that had a landowner that was literally breaking ground to dig a building. We had to be able to move them. And so when there has been either private land infringement, public rights away, or public health. We have had to do that. This was, and I shared this with the advocates, I shared it with the member, the residents there. This was a site we were intending to resolve into housing. We had about 50 units available. When we first went to talk to folks at this encampment, there were about 40 people there. What happened, sometimes happens as soon as we show up now to talk to people in encampments, they know what might be happening. And in about a week, that encampment went from 50 people to 120. And so that both meant we did not have nearly enough units to house them anymore. And the growth of that encampment suddenly got very large. It was in two public rights away. It was in the middle of a street. It was unsafe for the folks that were camping there and for the residents. And so we did not at all want that to be the outcome. We get to talk about now, this phase two is a little different than phase one. You know, phase one was we had 200 person encampments here at, you know, 20th and Lawrence. And we were bringing on 400 unit hotels where we could move massive encampments into large numbers of open units. We're not buying a hotel every 6 weeks now. Our goal now is, as people move out of those hotels or out of our current shelter sites and units become available, we move new people in. So the goal is that's 50, 60, 80, 100 people a month. That might be two or three encampments of 30 people each that we can resolve into housing.
And when you say move out, you mean move on to like more permanent housing?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
When they move
into their own permanent units.
Okay.
So this is
so it's not just kicking people
no,
out.
No, one ever is kicked out of an all-in site unless there's a serious safety risk or they commit a crime. No, the idea is they've now gotten their act together, they've gotten a job, they've gotten their first couple of paychecks, they got a unit to rent, and they're moving out to an apartment. So it's like graduation. It's great success. And so when they move out, then units available, but they generally become available 30 or 40 at a time. And so usually that's what we're doing now is a lot of smaller, like we closed an encampment at 4th and Navajo this week, moved everyone into housing. That was, I think, 40 people. And so that's more, and that's one of the largest ones left in the city. A lot of what we're doing now is two or three people in a small tent under a bridge or three or four in a side alley because they're not all big, large encampments anymore. This one was one that just was had gotten very big and unsafe, and so we didn't have enough units in that moment, and we thought the safety risks were too high for the neighborhood. But our hope, if we do this well and partner with advocates, is we get, as encampments grow, they're 10, 20, 30 people, we match them to units, close them into housing.
So is that you kind of mentioned this. Is like the acquisition of hotels and new land and maybe building, is that slowing down? Or I guess where are we with the housing supply that you were working on?
So we're doing two things. One is, you know, we built and acquired. We just opened our second tiny home village this year. So we've already opened two new sites. We're at a little more than 1,200 units available now. We've moved more than 1,500 people off the streets and indoors. So those are all great. Our goal is to have two things, both enough units to move people into, and also, as you were saying, that people are moving. We call this transitional housing. You get stabilized, get settled, but we want you to be in your own apartment with your own lease. And so the push is really to get people moved up and out into their own independent housing. And so if you think of about 2,000 people that we think are unhoused, we want to move them all through units. You could have 1,000 units and move 2,000 people through those if everyone moves on to permanent housing every 6 months. And so, or you could have 2,000 people by having 2,000 full units and move everyone through once a year. So we're trying to do both. We're both trying to bring on more units, but we're also trying to encourage all of our providers we're partnering with to be more urgent and successful at getting people transitioned into permanent housing. Because if we do that, we wouldn't have to buy three more hotels or site five more tiny home villages. We could just move the throughput faster. But I will say we're doing both right now. We're both looking for some more sites, and we're looking to have people move up and independently more quickly.
Speaking of providers, I am reminded of the recent situation at the former DoubleTree Hotel by I-70, and the Salvation Army has been coming under some criticism for the way they've been handling that city contract. I wonder, since you all at the city took over the security for that building from them, one of their explanations for why they hadn't already implemented better security is that they didn't want to have more of like a hostile or like more of like a, you know, a police presence at the place, mm-hmm. because it would be a little bit less of a home for the people living there. Are you hearing that from residents? Are people having less of a, are they having less success transitioning through because there's now more security?
We haven't heard that. We have heard more folks who say being safe in my own home for me means feeling like I'm not worried that the guy next door has a gun or is going to be dealing drugs out of his room, and what kind of risks will I face? And so we took really seriously that it's our obligation to keep people safe. And this is a good example. We opened the hotel, you know, the last hotel you've been to, it doesn't have one point of entry and one point of exit. There were about seven there, and we don't, you know, this is not Joe Clark from Lean on Me, if you remember that back in the day, where you lock all the doors and there's only one entrance. It has to be safe, but when you have seven points of entry to a hotel, you have people that can come and go and not know if they're residents or why they're there. And so we did things like, you know, we wanted to secure all those entrances, so we had to have security guards at the other entrances, so they, as we work on badged access, we'll have badged access through the front door. We'll have, there's not a guest policy, so you can't bring guests in. And there's a no weapons policy. We did, the Salvation Army did do searches of the rooms to make sure there were no other weapons in the rooms. And I think the benefit is when we have this set up now, we wouldn't have to do that again, because when new guests arrive, you come in once, your bag is searched, you go through kind of magnometer. Is that what they're called? You go through a kind of metal detector, magnetometer. So no one should be bringing any more weapons in. Now everyone can feel safe. And it's sort of like when you get on a plane. You got to go through TSA and it's annoying for 10 minutes. But when you get past TSA, you know, you have your whole flight feeling safe. You don't have to worry if someone's going to cause any danger on the plane. So our goal is to do both. We want the sites to be very trauma-informed, very friendly, very welcoming and homey. And people do need to feel safe in those sites. And we've had real success at our other sites doing both. This was a site where we had larger number of people, more exits and entrances, and we thought it needed more safety protections.
Hmm. Let's talk about the conversation around All In Mile High, this yes. effort that you're making, because we've noticed what seems to be an increasingly vocal group of Denverites, maybe some non-Denverites, who are really upset about the homelessness issue here in Denver. I'm thinking about the Instagram account, Do Better Denver. Are you familiar with this?
I have heard of it, yes.
Are you feeling pressure from these accounts, their followers, people who are just upset about what they think is the problem?
No, I think we feel pressure to deliver results for Denverites, and that's been our commitment. And I think when we look at results, you know, we've moved 1,500 people off the streets and into housing. That's what we heard from the White House, more than any city in American history has done in this amount of time. And 95% of those folks are still successfully housed. And, you know, if you walk out the door where we're standing downtown, first time in, I don't know, 20 years, there's not a single encampment, not a single tent in all of downtown Denver. And that's true for many other parts of the city where we had large, large encampments. And so we think that's transformationally good results. You know, we have fewer outdoor deaths. We have people that are more connected to services. Those are all really positive outcomes. Some of the folks are upset because, you know, they didn't want there to be housing for people that were unhoused in their neighborhood. And we understand that, but we think this is a problem the entire city faces and the entire city should be part of the solution. So we did intentionally put them in neighborhoods that want representative of the whole city's population. And we think we can do a good job of keeping those neighborhoods still safe. I think more of the complaints we hear now are about the folks that we've put into housing at these sites than about what's still happening on the streets. We think that's some vastly better outcome for the city. So we think we're delivering real results and we're not slowing down. And so we're very proud of the progress. We'll stay at it. I always welcome fair criticism and we'll take that. But I think there's a whole set of, I think, people who don't believe you should provide services to folks that are homeless or believe you should just throw them in jail or make them disappear somewhere. That's not our belief. And so the sort of the MAGA accounts out there that want to fight that battle, they're welcome to do that. We're really focused on how we get people services and get them supports.
Well, it does really feel like, at least to us, that this sense of like frustration or anger is like, it's really rising with certain folks. I mean, and some of them are really mean. Like it's mean in a way that I don't remember. Like they were mean to us when we talked about them. I don't know if you've seen what they're calling you, but they're calling you Meth Camp Mike. Have you seen this? What do you make of this?
I just don't pay attention to that folk. Like I'm happy to talk to real individuals who want to come to town halls and have real conversations or want to meet with us. Folks that hide behind anonymous accounts and cast aspersions without information doesn't bother me or waste my time. I focus on the residents we're serving, the folks that are unhoused we're supporting. Feedback from them I take very seriously. You know, so if I talk to a business owner who's worried about crime in their business, we'll get on it right away. If we talk to a resident who got into a All In site and needs better access to wraparound services, we're all over that. So we're very attentive to how we deliver high quality services, but the folks that are cheering for the city to fail are not helping anybody.
So we had another question about the sort of rise in anger towards unhoused folks in particular. And we have a question from David Gordon, who is a longtime vendor with the Denver Voice. And he said, there is a fear of a civil war between the housed and unhoused community, with more violence than usual being initiated against the unhoused. What is the mayor doing to discourage the increased hostility and violence against those of us who have nowhere to live?
I mean, this is exactly why this conversation is so important, because I think these other folks are fomenting fear and anger and trying to incite violence or hatred against our neighbors. I don't think that's helpful to us. It's the same kind of spirit you saw in the January 6th insurrection, right? I don't think that's productive for us or for the country. So what we try to remind people is, you know, these are neighbors that have fallen on hard times just like any of us can or any of us have. I mean, anyone that's had someone in their family who has struggled with mental health or who struggled with addiction, and I've had both, knows you're never that far from being in a spot where you need somebody. And so we just try to connect people back to the humanity and create opportunities for folks to reconnect with people they may not have relationships with before. We did a neighborhood cleanup down by the Tamarack, which is the family shelter in Southeast Denver. Had never had a family shelter or any homeless shelter before. It was a fair amount of pushback and concern when we went down there. And now when you go down there and you talk to neighbors and you talk to residents, they are really very pleasantly surprised by how it's going. We got church and faith groups coming and running events there. We're working on child care centers there. We're working on a playground in the backyard. I talked to business leaders that in the neighborhood, they feel good about what's happened. And so those aren't quite as sexy as stories, but there are a lot of places in which, you know, it's, and again, you had to think about the context of, you all remember this debate about kind of the Park Hill tiny home village. I mean, that was three years of debate and a lawsuit to house 40 people. You know, we housed 1,200 in 6 months on 8 different sites. There's no way you're going to do that without people having some pushback. What's remarkable for us is we got it done anyway. The outcomes are going to be very strong and people are safely housed and off the streets. And so we feel like that's our primary responsibility in that. We feel like we've done a good job.
Last time we talked, we focused a lot on the newcomers from Central and South America. It seems like the number of arrivals has slowed since then, and your budget cuts weren't as deep as you anticipated. But I want to ask about this new playbook that you published, because you put this out. It's for addressing this issue, and you're inviting other cities to follow it. Why did you do that?
Yeah, because what we feel like is we've worked hard at trying to solve each phase of the puzzle around migrants that have arrived. And I was excited to talk to you about this because you're one of the few folks that do kind of long form intellectual discourse on hard problems. And what's happened is the phase of arrivals have changed. And so in the first phase of arrivals, most folks that came, in part because Governor Polis and I and others pushed Secretary Mayorkas to extend what's called temporary protected status to Venezuelans, that meant every Venezuelan that arrived up through about October of last year could get work authorization in about 30 days. So we built our program around that structure, where if you came in and you'd stay in a hotel for 42 days with us, that's long enough to get situated, get your work authorization applied for, get it approved, get an apartment, get a job, and you're up and on your own. If you remember, Secretary Mayorkas got impeached for that effort by the Republicans. It's been very controversial. So as that's changed, now almost all of the folks that arrived to us no longer have temporary protective status. They no longer have this path called Customs and Border Protection 1, which also gets you 30-day work authorization. You know, we kind of mastered that plan. We did almost 2,000 work authorizations in 1 month, the most of any city in America in March, to get those people into work. But then all the folks that were left were what we call asylum seekers, which means you didn't come in at a point of entry. You just came in between the points of entry. You might have come across the Rio Grande, arrived in El Paso, and said, I need asylum. And those are the folks that have no path to work right now under the legal structure, unless those are the folks that arrive in Denver. They say, Mr. Mayor, all I want is a job. And right now they have a court date to appear for their asylum case, and those court dates are in the year 2031. So they have a 7-year wait for an asylum case, and you cannot work until that's adjudicated. And that's why we have folks with squeegees on Colorado Boulevard. We have folks in Home Depot parking lots looking for day shifts because they can't get legal work. So we've now found a way to solve this problem, which is we can proactively apply for asylum for them today. Instead of waiting 6 years for the court case, we can apply today. It's very labor intensive. It takes like 20 to 30 hours per case. So most cities don't do it. So what we realized is to serve this population well, we needed more time. Because if you apply for asylum, it then takes 6 months until you can get work authorization. By the way, it still takes 7 years till they decide on your case on the merits. We can't fix that because the courts are so backlogged. But in 6 months, you can get the right to work. So we just said, how would we build a plan for these folks who are stuck? And that plan is, we apply for asylum for you. We get you into a workforce training program that gets you English language skills, financial literacy, digital literacy. You identify careers you want to enter. We get you certifications like OSHA or CPR. And we get you into workforce training. So you learn that job and profession. So when 6 months come and you get your workforce permit, now you're immediately ready to enter the workforce. So we kind of cracked the nut on what is the hardest population no one else has served. And so now we think for other cities, we want to show them this is not a crisis. This is an opportunity. Like, you have folks here who want to work. You can give them a path to work. Whether you have folks with temporary protective status or CBP-1 or asylum, there is literally a playbook to serve any of the three groups, and we wanted to share that playbook so other cities could do the same.
just out of the kindness of your heart, this isn't like marketing the city or maybe marketing yourself a little bit?
No, not at all marketing ourselves. The reason is because we can do this well. We can't serve every asylum seeker in the country. So we don't want someone to arrive in San Diego or Kansas City or Detroit and them to say, sorry, we can't help you because you need asylum. We want, because the idea is if we all do our part, right? We're serving still, I think, the largest percentage of cities in the country or more or less the largest percent of migrants. We'll probably still continue to serve far more than our share. But it only works if all of us do it together, because otherwise you'll have folks show up in another city and not have services. So no, this is much more just open sourcing the API here to say, if you're trying to struggle to solve this, we tried to solve it too. But if we all do it together, then actually this crisis is just an opportunity. But people need to be able to know how to provide those services. So it makes it easier.
I have to say, so I'm reading news articles, like there's a wind down of the shelters for new arrivals where the services are slowing. We need less of that. However, like anecdotally, yesterday I paid $15 to three different groups of people at Alameda and Federal, Alameda and Sheridan, First and Sheridan to wash my windows. I'm not complaining about it, but visibly I'm not seeing a difference. I'm still seeing the same amount of folks out in the streets looking for help and work. What's going on?
Yeah, you had very clean windows when that drive was over.
I know, I'm like, at this point, I'm just like, just take my money because I don't want to say no.
This is exactly the problem we were trying to solve as two things. One is this is why we eliminated the hotel system where we had folks staying for 42 days. Because what we found was 42 days also would not help the folks who needed 6 months for the work authorization. So we needed a longer program. But for that longer program, we had a limited number of spots we could do within the budget. So we'll serve about 1,000 people over 6 months. But what we're seeing with a lot of those folks that are on the streets is they are folks that have been here for 2, 3, 4 months, maybe got an apartment for a while and couldn't keep it because they couldn't hold the job and now they're unhoused again. And so what we're also doing by closing those hotels is shifting a lot of our case management to supporting folks that are here already and still struggling. They still need legal clinic help. They still need work training help. They still need housing support. And so we have just the short kind of congregate shelter for folks that arrive for 2 or 3 days, but we're shifting a lot of our case management to folks that are already here and to preventing more of those folks ending up on the street without a path. But that what you're seeing is exactly what's happening around the country with those folks who their only path is asylum, and that's a 7-year wait. And so we're trying to solve that problem for the city and for the rest of the country to say those people with the least hope, there is some hope, but just harder work and longer work than what we did before.
But this playbook that you're publishing, and you're giving it to these other cities, and you're saying, we figured it out. Maybe it's just because your former opponent, Lisa Calderon, she was on our show a couple of weeks ago. She put this idea in my head. She said, Mayor Mike Johnston, he's just running for president. That's his whole long game here. He's doing this because he's got a whole course plotted out. He wants the Oval Office. Is this like promoting your plan to other cities? Is that part of some longer game?
No, it's the opposite. It is. I talk to mayors a lot who are trying to. Let me give you a clear example of just human services. Since the beginning of the migrant crisis, always from the start, about 50%+ of folks who arrive in Denver never wanted to stay in Denver. They were always trying to get to Detroit, Kansas City, Chicago, Boston, wherever. So they're going someplace else. They always were. Because, as you know, a lot of people got shipped to Denver because Texas just wanted to get them out of Texas. And they sent them because Denver was the cheapest bus ticket from El Paso, where the shortest spot up I-25. So at least half of the newcomers that arrive in Denver are going someplace else. If they go to someplace else that does not have a program for CBP-1s or for TPS or for asylum seekers, they're going to be on a street corner in one of those cities, squeegeeing with a family on the street and no support. That's not good for any of us. That's not good for, I think, the people who are trying to weaponize this as an issue, right? I mean, what's amazing is this is the single most controversial issue in American politics right now, and it probably is only hitting 4 or 5 cities. But somehow folks in Memphis are certain it's going to destroy Tennessee, right? Which is like it's been turned into this massive political battle, where our point is just it's not impossible to solve. It can be solved. We don't care if you credit us, use us. We just care that if people arrive in your city, don't either say you can't serve them or don't leave them outdoors or don't deny them access to services. Here's a simple way to open source it. We do the same thing. I was in Detroit on Friday. I got 3 great ideas from the Detroit mayor that he's going to give me, we're going to use on what the city can do to improve. So mayors do this all the time. We're nonpartisan. You're just trying to run stuff and make it work. And so I'll reach out to other people. I went to see the mayor of New York or LA on homelessness. We'll ask them about migrants. So mayor of Chicago, we have open conversations. I feel like it's a quite egoless group actually when it comes to how do you solve the crisis of the day. But no, this is, if anything, people will be more mad at us for trying to export these pro-migrant services to other parts of the country. We just want it to be easier for people to succeed.
Hmm. Well, Bree, maybe we should wrap up with another listener question.
Yeah, we have one last listener question. Does the mayor support a proposed change to the city's charter that would give city employees collective bargaining rights? Council members Serena Gonzalez-Gutierrez, Sarah Parody, Chantal Lewis, and Chris Hines are all supporting the proposal. It's also being pushed to the ballot, potentially, by the Communications Workers of America Union. Mayor, would you support collective bargaining rights for city employees?
Yeah, we've just started to get our head around this and read this proposal. Unions hadn't come to us to talk about it before. It was a surprise when it hit us. So that was unusual, because usually people would reach out in advance and say, we're thinking about it. And the challenge is, it would be probably the single largest change to the Denver Charter in a century, in 100 years. I mean, you're talking about, when you think about small things, be like, there's a proposed charter change to make the Human Resources and Community Partnership charter agency. That's been in the work for 9 months. We've had multiple hearings. We've had lots of conversations. It's a tiny change. This, as you're talking about 13,000 employees, how many bargaining units would they be? What would the process be for bargaining? What part of the career service protections that employees currently have would they give up? What would be changed? What are we trying to add? So I think for us, the question is, what is the problem we're trying to solve, and how do we solve that? Is it about wages? Is it about benefits? Is it about employee voice? And what's the right structure to do that? But we think this is a monumental shift. So whether or not we can squish it in the next 4 months or so before this November election, I think would be hard for us. We're very happy to sit down and work together, but I think this could be multiple years of planning for city agencies to say, Dottie alone has multiple thousands of employees with 12 or 13 different classification groups. Those might have 12 or 13 different unions. How would you represent those people well? So we're all interested in making Denver the best place to work, the best place to be an employee. One of our major focuses for this year is our goal around employee engagement, employee satisfaction. So that's a top focus for us. We just want to make sure we know exactly what the employee concerns are and how we address them. It had also never come up to us in any of my employee conversations. I'm doing town halls with all of our employees around the city. We get a lot of questions about things like access to childcare, access to parking, about the merit pay increases, about things like avoiding furloughs or others. So we've had a lot of employee conversations, and this hasn't come up yet. So we just want to sit down and say, great, what are the problems we're trying to solve? How do we solve them? How do we make sure they're going to work well to do them?
Okay.
But just to clarify, are you open to it?
Oh, yeah, I'm open to it. I've always said I'm open to the idea of collective bargaining. I've supported it in the past. I've been a part of it as a principal and a teacher, so I think it can work very well. This would just be the largest and most complex, I think, organization in the state to ever do that, and so just a fair amount to do to make sure we make it succeed.
Well, Mayor Mike Johnston, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was great to see you all. Have you done a review of the new Taylor Swift album yet? Has that been part of your...
Give us yours.
I was going to ask you, though, because we know you're a Swiftie by proxy.
I am. I have listened to, I would say, two-thirds of the... is it 37 songs,
yeah,
I think, on the album? It is quite long.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. It is not my favorite so far of the albums. And I do think that means in the race for album of the year, I feel like Beyonce has a definitive lead now.
We would hope so.
I think Cowboy Carter is fantastic.
Yes.
So.
No, agreed. That's all for today here on CityCast Denver. If you enjoyed this show, why not take a minute to tell Beyonce about us? Rate the show wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to our morning newsletter and learn more about us at denver.citycast.fm. We'll be back tomorrow morning with more news from around the city. See you later. Today on CityCast Denver, Mayor Mike Johnston is back to answer our questions and...